Today is Monday, the 19th of October, 2015. It's a Monday morning. All of you listening across the world know what we're caught up with here. So either we have to learn Torah this morning or stand guard and walk with our arms. In this room, most of us can't carry arms anymore, so that's why, Baruch Hashem, we're learning Torah. Yesterday, I dedicated the shiur in memory of two great women who were buried on Friday, 30 years difference in age. One, Beseva Tava, was Rebbetzin Adina Bernstein, and the other, of course, 30 years younger, also at Tzadeket Yesod Olam, Henny Lustig Machlis. As I mentioned, I knew Henny very well. I knew both of them very well. Adina, of course, I knew as a kid looking up. And she was married to Zivik Rishon, and I want to mention the name Rabbi Louis Werfel. And I made the point yesterday that Zivik Rishon to Rabbi Werfel, Zivik Sheni to Rabbi Michal Bernstein, these were classmates at the yeshiva, ordained in 39-40, and two fabulous talmidim of Reb Moshe Soloveitchik and Reb Dov Frevel. And Adina tied us together with an era gone by. She was still a remnant that knew the Revel family intimately, and she herself was an Isha Gedola. I cannot tell you, I have Chaverim who are well known, who had no Derech Eretz for anyone, but for Adina Bernstein, they had Derech Eretz, with Daila Chakima. So, of course, I mentioned the first husband was killed in World War II. He was, and I have to say that the computer, Harav Hagon, Reb Google, it's beyond comprehension what the computer can do for you. So I typed in this morning Rabbi Louis Werfel, and I got his entire biography, some of which I knew, but to see it in print and not depend upon memory, because I'm going back, Rabbi Werfel, I heard about him in the 50s, in 1951, when I came to yeshiva, his name was well known. Chaplain Louis Eliezer Werfel, 1916-1943, was the only Orthodox rabbi killed in action during World War II. He was known as the Flying Rabbi, a title he earned from soldiers as he traveled by plane to Jewish airmen in isolated locations throughout North Africa. And in 43, he was sent to North Africa, where he served as chaplain of the 12th Air Force Service Command, where his area of operation included Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and Sicily. Beautiful description. He was buried as a young soldier serving in the American Army in Oran, Algeria. Donald B. Butler was one of the soldiers who buried Chaplain Louis Werfel in North Africa with a proper Jewish funeral. Now, Butler's from the Butler family. It has to be Rafi Butler's father or grandfather. Which is it? Donald's father. It has to be father, according to the years. And a fabulous, well-known Torah family. In 1950, as per Army regulations, Chaplain Werfel's body was sent back to America, where his wife arranged for him to be buried. By then, she was his widow, who had remarried, arranged for him to be buried in the newly established state of Israel, in the cemetery of the religious Zionist Hapoel Mizrahi Kibbutz, Tirat Tzvi. At Tirat Tzvi, its school and synagogue were dedicated in Louis Werfel's memory, and his name is included on the Kibbutz Memorial for Soldiers Killed in Action. In 1949, the United States Army dedicated a boat, the P.T. Werfel. What does P.T. stand for? Anyone here a Navy expert? P.T. What? All right. You got to type into the computer PT, boat, information. In Chaplain Louis' first floor memory, and as is customary, Adina Werfel donated a set of candlesticks for the crew to use in the dining section. That also, what does it mean, a set of candlesticks? What does that mean? In case the electricity goes out, there should be I don't know. Chaplain Louis Werfel was survived by his wife, Adina, who later married Rabbi Michal Bernstein, Rosh Yeshiva at Reitz, His father Isidore, his sister Ethel, a brother Private Abraham Werfel, Rabbi and Mrs. Bernstein's son, Rabbi Dr. Moshe Bernstein, is currently a professor of Bible at Yeshiva College. So I just read that, and let's dedicate today's shir to Rabbi Louis Werfel's memory. It could be a PT, but what is it? Petrol torpedo boat. Thank you very much, and thank Reb Yitzchak, and thank Harav HaGaon Rav Google. Now, I also want to mention that the person who interviewed me, what was it, a week ago? I forget already. Life has so much is happening, it's hard to put it all together. Rabbi Chaim Dalfin. Rabbi Chaim Dalfin is a Chabadnik, born and bred in Chabad. He's put out a number of books, and he's given me I cited one of his other books. I'll cite it again. The Secrets of Chabad, or Chabad Secrets. There are two books out with similar titles. Chabad Portraits, Volume 1, he gave to me when he interviewed Rabbi Chaim Dalfin, and it's 2 weeks ago. Because today we say the Ten Talumata, and this is a very fascinating volume. Everything has put out a number like this. This is volume one. It's called Chabad Portraits. It's Ishiyut, people in Chabad, and portraits certain. It's not an ongoing history. In other words, it's taking certain individuals or certain happenings in Chabad and writing about it. What's very fascinating is that he has two chapters in here, one on two people that we discussed at length last year and this year. Has a chapter on the Malach, and he's interviewed the Malach's descendants, and he has a chapter on Barry Guraye, who, if anyone would have asked the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe in 1930, who will ultimately be the 8th Lubavitcher Rebbe, he would have said, my nanical Barry Guraye, Beryl Guraye, I believe he was called at the time. There's one correction I want to make on something I said in class, and here I throw it open to people listening. In Shir from September 7th, you mentioned Barry Guraye, Yitzgold of Carroll Street in Brooklyn, sent this to me. Married to Rabbi Krasinovsky's daughter. In reality, he was married in 1953 to Minna Haskin, the daughter of Alta Haskin. And there are more details in the volume, and I stand corrected. What troubles me is not that I'm corrected. I'm proud that someone takes the trouble to correct me, and I thank him very much. But I got that information from someone who's very, very close to the Chabad dynasty. His grandparents were, his parents were, and I wonder how he could make a mistake. And he told me many times, the name Karasinovsky, I heard from my friend many, many times as being Barry's wife's maiden name. I wonder if Haskin is not a son-in-law of Krasinovsky. In other words, can anyone inform me? Because for my friend to make a mistake like this, it's a little hard to comprehend. He knew the Rebbe like I know the Rav. So if I'm going to tell you Pesha Feinstein was the Rav's mother and she wasn't a Feinstein, wow, I'm making a bad mistake. So I'm just curious if there wasn't a Krasinovsky correction, but I want to correct myself. The name is Haskin. Now, if you recall, in relation to the Holes of Family that just came in Aliyah, so I mentioned about the Hasidic Minhag that everyone makes Kiddush. So Yitzgold again wrote to me that this topic has bothered him for a long time because it seems in the Shulchan Aruch of the Alter Rebbe, it is preferred that one not make Kiddush, each one shouldn't make for themselves. And he's asked a few of the Chabad Rabbanim why, and they something I heard from the Rav too that if someone else is making Kiddush, you have to have Kavana not to be Yotzei. That's very hard. You're hearing Kiddush, you're naturally being Yotzei. What does Yotzei mean? You're answering Amen. You're happy to hear it. And it could also be that the Alter Rebbe said that when Kiddush is made, when one person gets up and makes Kiddush for 500 people, Barov Am Hadrat Melech. So he asked me, what is the justification? Is there any other source? Frankly, I haven't gone into the issue in great detail, but offhand I can only tell you halacha lemaisa, among the Litvakim, I always saw that there was only one Kiddush. Among the Hasidim, I remember in the whole Sahon, each kid would make Kiddush. Today I saw in the whole Sahon, three generations, a father, a son, and a grandson making Kiddush. All right, I'm not here, you can't overthrow Minhag Yisrael, God forbid. I'm not saying that if you're a chassid and everyone makes Kiddush, you're doing something wrong. But halachically, it's questionable. But okay, Minhag Yisrael, when all is said and done, tank it's all, as we touched upon yesterday, as we're going to touch upon next week in Shia on the Sunday class. Now, also, coming back to the Debrin College, so two interesting emails came in. And again, it only sustains, supplements, complements. There is no question that when it comes to an attitude towards college, towards university, although the Rebbe and the Rebbe both studied together in Berlin, there is a chasm of difference, a tremendous cleavage between their points of view on college. And I can tell you, halacha lemaisa, I write about it in Washington, I lived it, I saw it, I heard it, I was part of the story. I'm not telling you anything ish mi pi ish now. I'm telling you, Jason, what I experienced. You follow me? And that's Chaim Gold. If you know Chaim Gold, I'll tell it very briefly. I've told it many times. I wrote it in Washington, but let me not take for granted that you have studied Washington thoroughly. But, it's an unbelievable little story. Chaim Gold, when Chaim came to Yeshiva, he studied in Yerushalayim. You don't know what that meant for me in the 1950s to meet a kid who actually studied in Yerushalayim. His Zayda was Reb Zev Gold. But his father died. His father, Reb Moshe Gold, who was the first rabbi in Englewood, which today is a Melucha. This was one little shul in Englewood. Who would believe that Orthodox shuls could go into the suburbs? It was all conservative and all reform. So Rabbi Moshe Gold was in Englewood. That's the first place I started teaching in 1959, and it's Talmud Torah, Avat Torah, Englewood, and his father died. When his father died, his mother called Chaim back. This was her son. You understand it very easily. And Chaim came back to America, and Chaim was Chaim, and he had learned, and he went to college 1 year, and he's learning with the Rav. And the next year, I take a look, when we're all going up to college at 3 o'clock, Chaim is not budging. So I say to Chaim, why aren't you going to college? So he double talks me. But what he really was saying is college is a waste of time. Well, what am I going to waste my time, college? So I was there was a wise aleck kid named Ani Rothkopf. So Ani Rothkopf, a normal kid, would mind his own business. But Chaim was a yatom. You follow me, Rafi? He was a yatom. So I went over to the Rav, right after Shia, the Rav is sitting here, I'm there, and I say to the Rav, Rebbe, Chaim isn't going to college this year. What are you saying? And he says, bring him in here immediately. So I go into the base medrash, Chaim is learning. I say, Chaim, the Rav wants to see you. So Chaim comes in, and I'm now, there are three people in the room. The Rav, Chaim is standing right here, and I'm in my seat right here. And the Rav says to Chaim, every syllable I'm telling you is exact, direct. He says, Chaim, he says, well, what's this that Arnold tells me? You don't want to go to college. You're not going to college. And Chaim starts to double talk. And the Rav cuts him off. And says, Chaim, let me tell you something. The Mishnah, I'm responsible for you. And he quotes, the Beis Din is Avim Shel Yatomim. I believe it's a quote from Baba Batra, but I give it to you in Washington, exact quote. And the Rav says to him, the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot says, Yofet Tamat Torim Derech Eretz, and he says, I don't know what Derech Eretz means, but one thing I'm certain, Bizman Hazeh, Derech Eretz means college. And so Chaim says, Rebbe, I'm too late to register. So Chaim says, you go upstairs, I'll take care of it. So then Chaim goes up. Yeah, you remember, it was one building. So Chaim goes upstairs, and the Rav says to me, who do we have to speak to? So I say, listen, we can talk to Rabbi Belkin, his secretary, Mrs. Atlas. Mrs. Atlas, Helen Atlas, was Dr. Belkin's right hand. She was his girl Friday. You know, any great president or Rosh Yeshiva or any great, or the Rebbe, you have to have a good staff. She was Dr. Belkin's ace. So we go into Dr. Belkin's office there. Mrs. Atlas stands up. The Rav walks in. And the Rav says, who is responsible for registration? And she says, Dr. Silverman, Zichrona Levracha. So the Rav says, get me Dr. Silverman. And she rings him up, you know, the extension. And the Rav gets on the phone, Dr. Silverman, this is Yosef Soloveitchik. And he says, and you can hear the tension upstairs. And he says, a young man will come to you. Please register him and do everything you can to help him. I want this man to go to college. Thank you very much. And then Chaim, about a half hour later, comes back into the basement. He says, wow, it's amazing. They gave me all the classes I wanted, and I didn't even have to pay a late fee. So, you know, I didn't bother to tell him there's a good reason why. Now, that was the Rav's attitude. And Yitz Rubin is sitting here. He can testify. He had a cousin. I knew his cousin, too. His cousin died young, Zichrono Livracha. His cousin graduated Maimonides. And what happened?
Also it was graduating
Harvard. He had a bachelor's from Harvard, and this was the Rav. And accepted in medicine. Well, his father was a doctor, right or wrong? Am I Yitzchak? His father was a doctor, right?
When his father graduated at Boston Latin School, that was a shoe into Harvard.
Right.
So he gets interviewed by the Harvard fellow, and the man says, Mr. Lesser, you have very good marks and grades, etc. You're even involved in sports. What is your ethnic background? This is a fellow who used to teach the Daphne and Shabbos in the show.
Right. This is Dr. Let me just say it over. Yitz is telling the story of Dr. Lesser, who graduated, what was it called, Catholic Boys High School?
No, it was called Boston Latin
School. It was the top, I know, the top high school. Yitzchak Twesky went there, a top high school.
Right. And
they asked him, he had good marks, and a sportsman, and they asked him what his ethnic background is. This is to get into Harvard or into medical school?
To get into Harvard,
okay.
And he
was teaching a Daf Yomi already at that time.
Right.
Wow.
Okay, so now, then he called Daf Yomi, but that's what he told me.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so he says, well, I'm
French Canadian, and my name is really Le Sir.
So he got in, and he got in
and went on to the medical school, and later became professor of cardiology at the medical school.
Can you imagine how he felt when his son went to Lakewood?
And here this kid graduates. By the way, Charlie, did you have all that trouble getting into Harvard, or by the 70s was easier? You didn't have to change your last name. All right. You did change your name. Hexter should be Heksha. Let's be honest about it. But if he would say, my name is Heksha, right away, the last in Israel, who gives the Heksha? He'll need three stumpfuls to walk around. I just saw some imported, what did I see? Oh, imported from Poland milk. What was it? Cheesecake, something made in Poland. Cholov Yisrael. Three different hechshes on it. Oh, it was hard cheese. And my children told me that the government is encouraging it to bring down the price of cheese here, that they have a monopoly on it. So I said, Poland, where did they get Cholov Yisrael? But it must be the Chabadnikim there. Or they bring in new powder from Israel. I don't know how they do it, but I don't believe a Bell's Heksha is going to lie in addition to a Beis Yosef Heksha and then the chief rabbinate. So, I remember when I was learning in Lakewood, and they were talking about this kid. They were furious at Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, because Rabbi Aaron was supposed to come to Lakewood after college, and instead he went on to Harvard to do a doctorate. And here was this kid who had graduated Harvard with a bachelor's, and instead of going to medical school, he came to Lakewood. And the Rav was very, very I don't want to use the words that the Rav used. Well, not, forget it. Let's not repeat. We don't have to repeat everything we know. But the Rav was very, very upset. Now, that's the Rav's attitude. And don't let anyone tell you differently that the Rav viewed cartilage, but the other. I mean, I know Rakefet is asked the Hakira in an ideal world. With all due respects to Rakefet, that Hakira is very nice. And Rakefet may have a right to ponder that Hakira. But in the year 2016, in the year 1996, in the year 76 and 56 and 36, the Rav held you have to go to college. We're living ger betoshav anochi machem, no ifs, ands, or buts. And the Rav felt, whatever, it's not the time to go into it. I can give endless lectures. The Rav felt you'll be ultimately the same London and even a bigger London. And there's a lot of truth to it. And I write about this in Washington. I can never forget it as long as I live. There was this fellow in Lakewood who was the cream of the crop, a tremendous matmid. And the Ribbono Shel Olam gave him strength. He never left the Beis Medrash. The only time he left, he was from Chicago. The only time he left was Shabbos to take a walk after early Mincha. That's the only time he left the Beis Medrash. And he would ask someone to walk with him. And a few times he asked me. It was the greatest, oh, what an honor to walk with this individual after Mincha. No, I admire him for another reason. He married a friend of my wife's who was an orphan from a Yekov family in Washington Heights. We were all very, there were so few Orthodox Jews then. There were no boundaries between us. And her father had died young. She didn't have money. And he married her and they had a beautiful marriage. No, he never went to college. Rakefet went to college. Rakefet went to graduate school. Many years later, I'm sitting on the A train, totally engulfed in learning, preparing my shayurim. I had just taken the 105 bus in from Maplewood, New Jersey to Port Authority. From Port Authority, I go to the A train. I'm taking the A train uptown, and I'm learning, and there's a tap on my shoulder, and there is the Matmid from Lakewood, who now has a family, and he's a stockbroker. And he asked me if he can speak in my shul, which I arranged for him, to the sisterhood and stocks and what he can do, and mutual funds were just beginning then. Let me tell you, at that point in life, the guy who went to college and wasted all his time was learning many more hours than the stockbroker. And if you know what it means to be a stockbroker, I remember the Shabbos after Kennedy was assassinated. He was assassinated on a Friday, those of you who recall, no one can forget that November 22nd, what was it, 1963, where were you at 1:04 when the news came through that the President of the United States was shot? I was in a garage getting gas in Valesburg, New Jersey, adjacent to Maplewood, part of Newark. Valesburg was the name of the section, filled with mafiosos. Newark was a town of the Italians at that time. I was getting gas, assassinated. I had two stockbrokers in shul. If they concentrated one word during davening, it was a miracle. They were pale. They were shaking. The stock market would reopen. I believe it was Tuesday when it reopened. Oh, my gosh, what's going to happen with the stock market? As Reb Chatzkel Levenstein said in a Shmuis in Panovich, he said, the president from the United States, he said, if they would have told me the president of the United States is going to be assassinated, I would have never believed them. So Baruch Hashem, this was the Rav Shita. What are we hearing? What's that? Outside the building? It's outside? Well, I can't hear. It's in the building, but it's not the microphone. Oh, yeah. It's, someone has a scooter. All right. If they have a scooter, they need it, then we have to encourage it. So, you're right. It was a scooter. So, there's no question about the Rub's attitude. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, Yitz Gold again. And a couple of pointers regarding the Rebbe's position in university. It was known that there were many Chabad people who received permission from the Rebbe to go, and others did not. My dear student, Rabbi Dr. Mark Weiner of Chicago, whom I quoted yesterday in a different context, also, I recall decades ago, a Chabadik once told me that the Rebbe Zitzal once responded to a bacha who asked about going to college to the effect that just because I climbed up on a roof and did not fall off does not mean that you should go climb up on the roof. So you see, there's a sea difference between the Rav and the Rebbe. Those words of the Rebbe could never have been attributed or uttered by Mori Rebbe. The Rebbe's position was Tzichim Lahavchin. They're those that can handle college and those that will be swept away by college. And there's no greater example, which I give in honor of Mark, is his Rebbe, my dear friend, Rabbi Abba Brand Spiegel. Abba, when he eulogized the Rebbe at the end of Shloshim, mentioned to the class that the Rebbe encouraged him to get a doctorate. Remember, mentioned in public in the Beis Medrash. Could you picture the Lubavitcher Rebbe encouraging Rav Ranspiegel to get a doctorate? Lo chaya v'lo nivra. And you follow me, Danny? That's the difference. According to the Rebbe, it depended on the individual. I don't know. A Rebbe has to size up. He looked at Alex and he said to Alex, get a PhD in philosophy. You follow? He looked at that Yomo and he said, you shouldn't even graduate Yeshiva College. And Baruch Hashem, the Rebbe's words have almost become entirely true. Okay? So I want to make that clear. All right, now to today's show, I want to pick up where I left off. First of all, I want to thank the response from around the world. It's very humbling to me. I have to be honest, the shiur like I gave last Monday, I could not have given 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago. But thank God, time is much done and I haven't wasted my time. Okay, I thank Steve Gross who said, and Natan, he said, you got a bargain, I only charge 36 grand, the Rebbe's in a generous mood. Steve felt it should have been much more, but with all being said and done, what's amazing is the counter, the reaction I got. And here with the Rav, it's a classic example where the Rav is quoting, and when it's not Shas and Paiskim and Rambam, you will always find he's not quoting, it's not entirely exactly what. And a dear student of mine actually sent me a clip. We don't even know the date. All we know is this was recorded in Boston on a Saturday night. The fact that it's in English would indicate that it's probably in the early 60s, the mid 60s, I believe in the 50s. Yitzchak, do you remember when the Rav switched from Yiddish to English in Boston?
He switched around
56, 57. That makes sense, because I know I've heard recordings out of Boston that are fabulous Yiddish, but those are 55, 56, 54. He switched. Someday, not in our lifetime, and 120 years from now, this will all be available, but what can we do with
it? It's not destroyed by sitting in someone's
closet. It can't be destroyed anymore. At least I hope not. Okay. So, believe it or not, in that shia, the Rav tells the exact same story that I quoted from his writings, Ishalacha, that in my footnote I make reference to a recording of the Rav in YU, I believe in 1980, where he tells the same story. And here's an excerpt from one of the Rav shiurim in Boston. I don't remember which year, I just saved the clip. Ah, but here he corrects the Rav. The Rav tells you the story that it was one of the Chabad Svarim. It was a Sefer of Reb Yitzchak of Hamel, who was not one of the Rebbe's. The opinions expressed in the Sefer from Kabbalah Svarim, not from Hasidus. The Rebbe Rashab, that's the fifth Rebbe, Reb Shalom Dovber, addressed Reb Chaim's concern in the first Maimah, of his famous Taf Reish Samech Vav, and explains it at different levels. And who was this Reb Yitzchak Isaac of Hamel? author of Chana Ariel was such an outstanding disciple of Rabbi Shneur Zalman and Rabbi Dov Be'er, the first and second Rebbes of Chabad. And when the later passed away in 1827, Reb Isaac was seriously considered as a candidate for the succession. He refused, instead becoming the chassid of the eventual third rabbi, the Tzemach Tzedek, who was 20 years his junior. And Ein Hachinami, my Talmud sent me a printout from the Rashab. It's amazing how Chabad, all the Sichot, all the Maimarim. And then he sent me a printout of all the Mukubalim. This is all off the internet. This is from a website called Ascent. Rebbe's Kabbalists, Sages, Biographical Briefs. And in here you find the endless biographical briefs of Mukubalim. And in here you find the information on Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac of Hormel. Now, I want to ask you, can you play the tape of the rabbi? I don't think anyone will understand it. You have to send it to them on an email. They have to listen very, very slowly. His sprach, unless you know the Rav sprach, his English was not Bostonian English. It was accented with the Europäischer English. In addition, his vocabulary was unbelievable. I mean, the man was a genius at languages. But I don't know, it's not that easy to understand his English. I can understand every syllable, but that's a different story. But all right, let's play it for a second. Let's see if we can hear the Rav tell the story. And he tells it with a little different details. And he tells a joke in the story that when they were standing there waiting for the man to come home, so Rav Chaim said to Rav Simcha Zelek, look, we're standing here where we can't learn Torah anyway, we're waiting, so let's take a look in the Chabad Sfarim. The implication being that Chabad Sfarim are not Talmud Torah, you follow? It's a little joke there. Min learned nishteir saivasai, zomalat ankuk and davas is done the Chabad Sfarim, the Chabadska Sfarim. And then Reb Simcha Zelek opens it up and he starts quoting, Leman Chasto, Leman Tuvo, and Reb Chaim cuts him off immediately, Leman Ritzono. Go ahead, play it. Turn it off for a second, hold it. Did you understand that? One time Reb Simcha Zelek told me, all right, they won't understand. Yeah, okay, do me a favor. Anyone who wants to hear it, ask Yomo to email it to you. Yes?
You can put it on YU Torah as an attachment to the shir.
You can put it on YU Torah as an attachment to the shir. Okay, very good, very good. But it's the Rebbe was saying that Amol HaTreb Simcha Zelek, I hear him in English, but I hear him in Yiddish. In other words, what can I tell you? The Rebbe to me is Yiddish. But it's interesting, even in 56, when 57, when the Shurim were kulo Yiddish, outside class, I spoke to the Rebbe in English. In class in Yiddish, from Geretten Lernin, but outside the class, I spoke in English. Abba Braunschweigel, whose native language was Yiddish, he always spoke to the Rav only in Yiddish. You got to know where Abba Tiken, it's a name you don't know anymore. He was one of the most, Mark will tell you about him. He was a wonderful, wonderful Rebbe. Later he left ship to go to Landa College. He was the Rosh Yeshiva in Landa. He brought in Rabbi Parnas to Landa. They made big offers, I understand, to Rabbi Schechter, but he remained in YU. And Avraham Braunschweigel came from a Hasidic home. His Zayda was the famous Gerer Rebbe, Rav Avraham Mordechai, the Re'ein, that was the son of the Sfat Emet, that was the third Gerer Rebbe. He was a Gaon Adir, a new Kol HaTorah Kula by heart. And he, under his tutelage, Geir, became hundreds of thousands of Hasidim. And when Abba's grandfather walked into the room, the Re'ein, the Gerer Rebbe, stood up for him. He was the Gerer Rebbe's Melamed in his youth. And the Gerer Rebbe had tremendous derech eretz for him, like the Rav had for Rabbi Riesberg, and like the Rebbe had for his Rebbe in his youth. The Melamed Dar Dekei, we call it. And Abba was a survivor. He went through the hell of the Holocaust. So when the Rav switched to English, so most of the guys in the class were happy and sad. They were happy because English was easier than Yiddish. They were sad because the Rav's English, when he translated the terms of Reb Chaim into English, we had to break our heads to follow him. But Abba was very upset because to him, Yiddish was the language that you taught Torah. And when you studied with Abba, what language was it?
English.
English already, all right? Kanaim Hara. Now, that talk and that concept, and I don't want to go through it again, but as I developed it, it's very simple. The Lithuanian approach is like the Mishnah in Chagiga. There's certain questions which will remain unanswered. And only a fool is going to spend time what was before, what will be after, what's on top, what's underneath. You're a human being. You have limited ability. You have limited understanding. You have limited concepts. And be satisfied that you cannot know everything. And your role in life is to be great in Shas and Paiskim. This is the heart of Yiddishkeit. Ein am haritz chassid. You can't be a chassid. You can't be a tzaddik. You can't be a lamdin if you're just an amaritz. If you spend all your time making a living, running around, wasting time, whatever. A Jew has to learn. A Jew has to develop himself. And your biggest responsibility in the world is yourself. And I can add to what I said last week. This is the famous story with the Chafetz Chaim. When the Chafetz Chaim gave his shmuas in Raten, because people don't realize the Chafetz Chaim built the yeshiva in Raten, but he really wasn't the Rosh Yeshiva. He didn't say Shayurim. His sons-in-law said Shayurim. Reb Naftali Trepp said Shayurim. But when the Chafetz Chaim gave his shmuas, everyone ran, the whole yeshiva emptied out and came to the Chafetz Chaim's house to hear the Chafetz Chaim give his shmuas. Ay, halabai, we would have a tape, a recording, a movie like we have of the Chafetz Chaim coming to the Knesia. And one of the Chafetz Chaim's famous shmuasin was how to be mashpia, how to influence other Jews. And the Chafetz Chaim says, when I was young, I traveled around giving sichot and trying to influence, and I got absolutely nowhere. When I grew older, I reached the conclusion I shouldn't travel, I shouldn't go, I shouldn't attempt, I should sit in my house, and I'll have great influence. They said, how? And he gave a mashal. He said, develop yourself, work on yourself. It's like a cup that floweth over. When you fill a cup with wine, if you fill it too much, it overflows. When you fill yourself with Torah and Yirat Shamayim, it overflows, and that's the way you will influence. That is a Litvisher approach. No Litvak is going to stand on a street corner and give out tefillin and give out matzah and give out lulav and etrog. It's not a Litvisher world. You want to observe, you want to learn, come see, learn, come to class, be part of the B'nai Torah, the Chabura, the Lamdanim. Don't worry about everyone else, and certainly don't worry about the non-Jews. May God bless the Tsar and keep him far from here. Fiddler on the roof. It's exactly a Litvisher approach, a healthy approach. I was raised on this approach. Chabad, totally, absolutely, completely different. And that's what we spoke about. God made the world Laman Tuvo, Laman Chasto. God needs a world. Dira B'Tachtonim. A Litvisher Talmud Chacham never mentioned these words. Dira B'Tachtonim. It's beyond his comprehension. But we explained it last week. Yisrael b'raita v'kudsha b'richa chatu v'yitnu lecha keta malchut. If you understand that, then you have the key to understanding Chabad. You have the key to understanding the seventh Rebbe. You have the key to understanding all that has happened and is happening until this very moment. And this is why Chabad, and I said it yesterday, I say it again, I said it last week. I told this Chabadnik interviewing me, with then again we got speaking about the matzav here, and I said I would have more confidence in Netanyahu if he put on tefillin every day. And the Chabadik reacted right away. I'm sure he puts on tefillin every day. So he is a different, you understand. A Jew is a Jew. Stand on a street corner. The story I told you about Kanyon Hada, it's a classic story. And that ties in with the picture I showed you yesterday. Here, one of the waiters that came over to put on tefillin was a waiter wearing a yarmulke the whole time. I thought to myself, what's going on here? Someone wears a yarmulke, don't see daven in the morning? What's this? That's the picture I showed you yesterday. Remember after class? With the satmar, remember, Danny? The satmar's an anagul. A chabatnik is putting tefillin on, and you got to read all the comments. And they're right. What's going on here? Doesn't this kid put on tefillin in the morning? He wears a kippah. What's he doing? So Rakefet, being a litvisher, raised among litvisher lamdonim, I was melamed schus with lamdonim. Your father, I told you, we knew, he was smart enough to know there's a mitzvah to put on tefillin all day. You can take off the tefillin, put on the tefillin, make a brach again. If there's hesach dat, it's not a problem, right or wrong. Our shailas, how come we don't wear tefillin all day? Shouldn't I be teaching with tefillin? We had here in BMT, we had a few kids who sat all day with talis and tefillin on, with tefillin on, all day. You see in the old store, in the old city, you see kids walking with tefillin on. All right, this was could be the original Jewish minhag. This is what they did at the time of Chazal. So I'm a lamed zchut that he put on tefillin in the morning, and he did the chabatnik a favor to get him off his back. He figured, all right, I'll put on tefillin again. But you see, this is a serious question. But look at Chabad, there they are, tefillin. And ultimately, I ended off the class, Vayitnu lecha keta malchut. And the Rav, how he asked the question to his Rebbe in Cheder, Rabbi Yaakov Riesberg, he asked his Rebbe, who was a direct descendant of the Alter Rebbe, why does God need a crown, coronation night? What's going on here? And he said, my Rebbe answered something I didn't understand him at the time. But then the Rebbe went into a whole discourse of understanding. And it all goes back to Dira B'Tachtonim, that God has to be recognized, God has to be acknowledged. He needs you to acknowledge him. If you don't acknowledge him, then Yisrael V'Araita V'Kutcha Berichu are no longer Chadhu. And if this is so, now we understand Chabad's concern for every Jew and even for Gentiles. We need you to acknowledge God in this world, to bring him down. And here I want to go further, and I want to quote a book that just came out a few weeks ago. By the way, a second edition is being prepared that will be better than the first and will include an index as well. The book I'm holding in front of me is by David Eliezeri. Have I quoted it before? David Eliezeri, the Rav in, Yobel Lindo, if I'm pronouncing it right, something like that. Let me see if I wrote it down. It's outside of Los Angeles, I think. Yobel Lindo. Yeah, Yobel Lindo. Closer. What it means, I don't know. Linda's a girl's name, but what does Yorba mean? Under an hour's drive from Los Angeles, and if there's not much traffic, you can even do it, I understand, in 45 minutes. And there's a beautiful Chabad center there. David Eliezeri, who's been there for years, has built a melucha, and he put out a book, a very fascinating volume, The Secret of Chabad, Inside the World's Most Successful Jewish Movement. He makes a point here on page 65 that hit me between the eyes because it's so absolutely true. You take the United States. Okay, before World War II, the only player in the United States that had any influence on the Orthodox scene was what today is Yeshiva University. With all due respects to Teir of Adas and Chaim Berlin and RJJ, you're dealing with lightweight, minor organizations. They were in the minor leagues. Yeshiva College and Yeshiva already were the major leagues. But what were they trying to do? Their dream? To retain the Orthodox synagogues, that every last synagogue shouldn't pull down its mechitza and go over to the conservative movement. But there was no major worldwide view. Torah, we knew. I grew up a little bit after the era, but I know the era well. You knew you were an absolute minority. You knew that the Reform and Conservative Reconstructionists would conquer America, had conquered America. Halavai, we should keep the few synagogues that still have a machitza. And that was the battle. It didn't go beyond that. After World War II, the Sheret HaPleita came in. Now, I've spoken to many people in the Sheret HaPleita, and they've often asked me, who built Yiddishkeit in America? And they sort of think that they take all the credit. Yes, they deserve a tremendous amount of credit, but the structure was there for them to build upon. But if you take the Sheret HaPleita, what did they dream about? Protecting their own backyard. In other words, take Satmar. Satmar, unbelievably successful. Protecting their own backyard. Tens and tens and tens of thousands of Satmar Hasidim. Not all of them at Tzaddikim. We spoke about that yesterday. It comes up time and again in the responsive literature of modern times. Not all of them at Tzaddikim. They don't succeed with all their children. Where they don't succeed, sometimes the children go very far, and I have to tell you, books have been written that just ripped the hell out of Satma and that way of thinking. You look, forget about the book on Orthodox, take the documentary that won so many awards that I love, what's it, A People Apart, about Boropont by a YU graduate, Dumb. So there's one girl there raised in a Satmar home, a Bavav home, whatever, Chassidish home, and she's interviewed, and your heart breaks. You hear the story. She's gone to college and reading and in a whole new world. Had she gone to Stern College, she could have had everything she wanted in the world of literature and remained a good Torah Jew. No contradiction whatsoever. You follow?
But girls from those backgrounds go off all the time.
No, I understand. I understand. They have a very high. They say in Lakewood today, there's a tremendous problem of OTD, of kids off the derech. In Lakewood, which is also today, Litvish, Hasidish, what Litvish was, everything became Hasidish. But whatever they did, the Square Rebbe, the Satmar Rebbe, the Bavava Rebbe, every yeshiva you will mention, their goal was to protect their backyard. Tells, halavai, reconstruct tells. But the goal was not to change the world. It was limited. Of course it was limited. Because all these institutions and all these people and all these survivors and all the Sheret HaPleita had a limited goal, to reconstruct themselves. Halavai, we should succeed in reconstructing tells that once was in Lithuania the way it was in Lithuania. Lakewood, halavai, we should succeed in reconstructing Kletsk, Alatmat America, Bavav. All right, go on and on. Not Chabad. See, if you take the concept that being a good Jew, being a chassid, being a chabadnik, involves doing everything you can to prepare dira l'tach b'tachtonim v'yitnu l'cha ketam malchut, then it's an entirely different ballpark. And you can start to understand the vast difference between Chabad and every other Torah institution, concept, movement in the world today. And this is a fabulous point. I'm reading it from page 65. The Rebbe was challenging the emerging strategy of the small post-World War II Orthodox community in America, referring to themselves as the Sheres HaPleita, the surviving remnant. Religious Jewry at the time was a combination of second-generation immigrants clinging to observance and refugees from the Holocaust. Then second-generation immigrants, that's young Israel. That's basically young Israel. Yeshiva College. Yeshiva College and Young Israel at that time, hand in hand. The OU was a minor league player at the time. It had just been, it just became involved in Kashrut. It just sort of is on the map, but still a minor league player. They hoped to preserve Judaism by turning inward, holding on to a committed core, recreating old world enclaves, and keeping assimilation at bay. A small group of followers, a small group of scholars had found refuge in the United States, where they established the Thuanian-style yeshiva in Lakewood, New Jersey, Baltimore, Cleveland, and New York. The new Chabad Rebbe viewed scholarship without responsibility for Jewish destiny as imperfect. Jewish observance without compassion and caring for others outside the Orthodox orbit as inconsistent with Torah. The new Rebbe advocated principled engagement with a society where observant Jews could make a contribution to modern life while enjoying its bounty of freedom and opportunity. No question, it would be easier to withdraw from engagement with the rest of the world, but he encouraged his followers to strike this balance of articulating Jewish values to the broader community, contributing to its welfare, and rejecting those elements that were inimicable to Jewish ideals. Other Hasidic rabbis who found refuge in the United States were attempting to build their own communities. Their response to the opportunity of America was to create havens, small clusters of Hasidim in Bronzeville, Williamsburg, later in Borough Park, reflections of the spiritual grandeur of a world destroyed in Europe. And I want to tell you, one second, Morty, this is a very, very insightful comment. And it's a direct result of what Chabad believes, what Chabad is all about. V'yitnu lecha keter malchut. By the way, in Israel, this very same question came up time and again. Agudat Yisrael withdrew. Shalom al Yisrael, give us B'nai Brak, give us parts of Yerushalayim. We don't want to be involved beyond. This was their approach. The Mizrahi, totally different. We have to be part and parcel of the whole country and influence it. Today, 60, 70 years later, you notice that both have shifted gears. Mizrahi, yes, responsibility for all, but a lot more building of Torah. What institutions have developed? And the Haredi world, so-called, you notice with a tremendous success, but the cup runneth over the walls of the ghetto. By their own Talmidim and Hasidim are being broken open. It's a slow process, but it's happening. But the Rebbe, his influence, there isn't a Mizrachiite in the world who hasn't been influenced by the Rebbe in his thinking. The Haraya, the government today, recognizes Shluchim as being Yotzei, the need to serve in the army. Shluchim, critically important for the Jewish people. It's an unbelievable synthesis of what's happening right before our eyes. Slow, surely, gradually, but it's there. But this insight, kol hakavod to Rabbi Eliezeri. Yes, Morin.
It means the Friedrich Rebbe, Chabad and the Friedrich Rebbe didn't have any outreach.
No, the outreach already begins with the Rashab. There already was a lot of outreach. But you got to understand, all of Hasidus was outreach. That's the whole beginning of Hasidus is outreach. The Baal Shem Tov, what was happening in Poland. But there's no question, with the seventh Rebbe, it became a formal discipline, as we would say. This did not exist before. You see, when I went to YU, The best students wanted to become rabbis. It was a different world. Today, you see, the rabbanim don't want to be rabbis. Everybody wants to go in chinuch and wants to be a Rosh Yeshiva. Some of the best minds don't even want to do that. They want to become medical doctors, want to go into high tech, finances. I've spoken, I know, Natan and I know a family, two fabulous youngsters. It's children of a Talmud of mine, a very dear Talmud. And these kids are cut out to be fabulous rabbanim. But their parents got to be medical doctors. You understand? Yes, learning. Everyone from YU is learning and important. But you see, with Lubavitch, even when we wanted to be rabbis, the concept of being a rabbi, you had a limited scope. I'm going to make people from, I'm going to go into a conservative temple and put on tefillin. I'm going to speak to Gentiles about the Sheva Mitzvot. These were concepts that were unheard of. The Rebbe formalized it, but a lot more. The concept of a Shaluach is basically the seventh Rebbe. Yes, it's true, Riatzad Shluchim, I'm not an idiot, I know the history. I met in Russia, I saw the results of the Riatz's influence. But the Rebbe turned it into a formal concept, not just 10 shluchim, not just 100 shluchim, thousands. And remember, it's not ending. It's going on right now. You traveled. You went where you went. Where did you have a Shabbos? Where did you have a minyan? My son-in-law, who has traveled all over the world for the state of Israel, don't go into more details. Whatever he does. It's not important now. What is important, the minute he's being told you have to go here, the first thing he does is he contacts the shaluach, and I don't want it recorded. I mean, the Mossad, the hotels where Israelis stay on official business are 99% of the time within walking distance of the Chabad Center, and there are reasons why. Okay, there's security, there's things, because without Chabad, we can't have proper security, and Chabad can't have proper security without the long arm of the magnificent state of Israel, Medina Israel. Okay? Sheikh Shetechei. Anyone who doesn't want to say, I don't understand, the Haredim, they used to make a prayer for the Tsar. You can make a prayer for the state of Israel. You don't believe Shehi Reshit Gulatainu? So you say Shetehei Reshit Gulatainu, Ribonish Nalailam. Rakep, it's a big Zionist. I'm not going to be upset if you say Shetehei Reshit. Follow me? Halavai. Don't. I'll tell you a story. Let's relax for a minute, but you'll get the gist of it. Told it to my grandson. He loved it. He loved the story. I told him when I was doing my research for my doctorate, I write about this, by the way, in Washington. So I'm doing my research for my doctorate, and Mrs. Revel and others are telling me Rabbi Revel was in jail. He was a Bundist. What all that implies? So, all right, I don't want the truth is I was able to validate every word she told me. But among other things to validate it, I had to find out where the Yiddish newspapers are from Russia from 1905, 1904, when all this happened. So it's at the Yiva Archives. Today, I believe the Yiva Archives became part of Yeshiva University with the museum. It's all together. There are three different institutions. I may be right, I may be wrong. I don't know. You can check it out. But I go to the Yiva Archives. It was Manhattan. I think it was on Fifth Avenue, if I recall. 16th Street and 5th, yeah. So I go to the Yiva Archives, and there I am, sitting there, and I'm all, how old was I? Let's say this goes back to, six, I was 26, let's say 25. So I'm sitting there with a kippah, and I see this lady sitting there, a real Fabrenta communist, Bundist, no makeup on, in her 70s, with her white hair and her piled up there. And she's looking at me with such hatred. And finally she blurts out to me, you religious Jews, you with your yarmulkes, you was the biggest enemies of the Jewish people and the universal man. And you made a prayer for the Tsar in your synagogues.
I look at her, I say, lady, I never was in Russia. I never died at that time. I never davened there. I never set foot. My parents were born in Harlem. I never made a prayer for the Tsar. What do you want out of me? But I could see the enmity. But you see from there, we made prayers for the Tsar. There are many shuls make a prayer for Obama. I don't know. Some maybe even make a prayer for Cohen Kerry, for the Secretary of State. Shame Rishon Yerkov. I mean, it's unbelievable. Not to make a prayer for the state of Israel.
How about this? But we'll all make a prayer for the state, but you'll take out that one theologically problematic line.
No, but what's theologically problem if I say shit the hay? Then we have no problem. Shit the hay. Baruch Hashem.
And if you leave out the term racial,
that's what I'm saying.
I don't know what's wrong with saying shit the hey ratio. All right, so let them say what they want. I want to say it. But why not say that? I don't argue.
There are reasons.
But whatever. I don't see any reason. If you say shit the hey, it's shovel a chol nefesh. But okay, leave it be. Now, here, I want to go one step further. And here he goes. He's very, very, very insightful. And we will spell it out in future Shayurim. But I want to quote David Eliezeri again. And I'm quoting from page 332. Now, Chabad has picked up, and this is something that Dalfin writes about too in another book that he gave me. This is called The Secret of Chabad. I think the other book is called Chabad Secrets. Not I think, I believe it is. Chabad Secrets. So Chabad, and he writes about certain personalities. Chabad has picked up very, very heavy money. There are people who have done very well in life, and they reach a conclusion that what Chabad is doing, no other Jewish enterprise does. And I don't have to tell you, overall, they estimate Chabad in the course of a year, its various places spend well over $1 billion, if not more. We'll come into the financial aspects, but not now. But what's interesting is you pick up a family, like the Rohr family. I know George Rohr, who today is the leading person in the family. And his father, Sammy Rohr, Zichrono Levracha, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, what they have given Chabad is base probably over $1 billion already. And without going into that, they've done what, you have no idea what they've done in Russia, what they've done, and you take Lev Levayev, who's a real Chabadnik to begin with, how much he has given Chabad all over the world. So one of the things that the Rohr family did, they organized the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. And this gives courses on a very high level. It's also on the internet, and there's no end to the teaching that is done through the Institute, both for people who want to have basic knowledge and both for shluchim who want to know what's going on and techniques and what to use and children. And Rabbi Naftali Silberberg gave a course on what is the uniqueness of Chabad for the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. And I quote him. I'm quoting from page 332. People think the Rebbe was a scholar and an organizational genius. You see, people know the Rebbe. He knew. It's like I tell my grandson. My grandson just started the Technion yesterday. He's on a Tudai, and he's studying electrical engineering. So I think I told you, I joked around with him. He's a bright kid. And I said to him, when you get your degree in electrical engineering, you not only can be an officer in the army, you can also be the next Lubavitcher Rebbe, I said. Then I paused, and I said, and all you're lacking is you have to know all of Shas and all of Kabbalah Baal Peh and put it all together. So that's a very primitive view of the Rebbe. That on one hand, he had tremendous knowledge. On the other hand, he was an organizational genius, which he may or may have not been. He certainly surrounded himself with very good people. Rabbi Chadakov was an organizational genius. That goes without saying. Rabbi Shmayaru Guraye was an organizational genius. All right, I don't know if the seventh Rebbe may or may not, but they're lacking. So that's why they think the Rebbe has so many shluchim and he's so successful. They don't understand that his approach to shlichut, Chabad's mission in the world, was an extension of the world view of Hasidic philosophy. See, that's the key. You follow me, Morty? It's not just he was an organizational genius. It's part of the philosophy. You want to be a good Jew? You're a Chabadnik? You have to be a shaluach. This is the ultimate achievement. And Chabadnik can tell me that in 770 today, the best minds become shluchim. That there, it's not like in YU. I meet Reed's graduates. I meet fellows I taught here. What are you doing today? He's an accountant, a lawyer, a medical doctor. No, what has happened with all we put into you? Go out and teach. They're now running a course. They started with the Kollel, something on how to be Makarev people. You right? Right or wrong? Halavai, part of those students should come here and listen to these lectures. It would help immensely beyond the formal classes they're getting there, you understand? Fine to be Makarev. But here, it's the opposite. The best minds are running away. You got to be Maigel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If a good guy, a sincere guy, a chassid, a tzaddik, b'chol ma'asav, goes into some aspect of the rabbinate. By Chabad, this is what I'm told, why they have so many problems with the messianists in 770, because the greatest guys and the best guys are shluchim, they're sent away. And the people running the shlichut are not messianists. In other words, if you're a messianist dancing on the table and giving the Rebbe shishi on Shabbos in the year 2016, or you understand that I have to talmid and went to Chabad, so they davened at the messianic minyan to see what's going on. They couldn't believe their eyes. They call up the Rebbe Shishi. Sunday morning, the Rebbe is giving out dollar bills. I mean, it's beyond human comprehension. But, excuse me?
I mean, those guys are the guys who have mental problems.
Yeah. So you're saying that, but they think they're we're the guys with problems. But they're powerful in 770 because the greatest minds, the best minds, the good minds, the tzaddikim, the chassidim, they're being sent away on shlichut, and they're the ones that are left there. But, all right, even now, they're coming down hard. They had some of them arrested. They're trying to stop the fighting and what's going on. It'll take another 50 years, in my opinion. And Be'ezrat Hashem, by then it'll be totally quieted down. But that's a very important point. Not only that, you see, this is all part of the Chabad. You'll go to Ger. You'll go to Vishnitz. So you'll hear the Rebbe speak. In Ger, you won't hear the Rebbe speak. The Rebbe doesn't speak in public. It's part of his shita. Don't ask me to explain it, because a Rebbe, could you imagine, I want to be a Rosh Yeshiva, Rosh Kollel, but I'm not going to speak in public. No? But you'll go, the Friedrich Rebbeim, the Pnei Menachem, who I knew, Rebbe Simcha Bunim, Rebbe Yisrael, these were great, Rabbi Israel, a great individual. You go to Bells, the Bells of Rebbe, say what you want. He really has organizational skill. He is a manhig, he is a leader. I mean, we live in a slightly different world. We don't agree with everything, but you got to give credit what he rebuilt. So you'll go hear a Shmuis, you'll hear a nice Divrei Torah. You'll hear one time the kids in BMT went to the Belza Rebbe and they came back and they told me over what he said that Friday night. It was exactly what I said that Friday night in the family situation where I was, word by word, what the Belza Rebbe said, what I said, and we couldn't have heard each other. Maybe we were robbing from the same source. That could be. That's possible. But you'll hear nice words of Torah. Not nice words to be mitchazek in Shabbos and to be mitchazek in Tarat Mishpacha and to be mitchazek in Limud HaTorah and to be mitchazek in Chassidus, at least from a Chassidic point of view. All right, that's the Rebbe, beginning with that very first talk of Basi Lagani, which I purposely say it the way the Rebbe said. I have a video of the Rebbe talking about it. Basi Lagani. See, he demanded that the Hasidim have to do the work. It was a different demand altogether. He called it avoda b'koach atzmo, one's own efforts. Listen up, fellow Jews. The rabbis of Chabad demand that their Hasidim take personal action and not rely on the Rebbe. After all, even God himself does not impress piety or proper conduct upon everyone. We must work with the entirety of our bodies and souls. I will not withhold my assistance. God forbid, I will help to the best of my abilities, but I cannot do the work on your behalf. And you see, this is a powerful demand. A different Hasidic Rebbe will be very happy if you're firm, you're good, you come to the Tish, you fabreng, you're a Shomer Shabbos, you raise your kids to be good Hasidim, you all dress like they dressed 100 years ago, 200 years ago. You're right, you, what Rakefet calls Hasidic movement, it's building a portable ghetto around yourself. It's a very ingenious idea. Don't dismiss it. Today we can't live in a real ghetto. It's impossible, because you walk two blocks out of Meir Sharim, you'll see pictures on the wall that open the kids' mind. I know from psychologists that Bob Yesh used to tell me stories of kids who wandered out of Meir Sharim and saw some of the signs on the billboards and what it did to their worlds and the psychological help they needed. You can, so, but the engagement abroad, with prayers, with Lange Begodim, you're building a portable ghetto around yourself. But the Rebbe, see, you got to work, you got to do, you have to create, you have to reach out, you have to teach, you have to build a dira b'tachtonim for the Ribbono Shel Olam. V'yitnu lecha ketamalchut. The Rebbe can help, he can guide you, but you have to do the work yourself. See, something wrong here. Another Rebbe, you'll come with a kvittel, you go to the Gerer Rebbe, you'll take away an apple, an orange, depending on the season. But these words to be stressed, that's not enough. You got to get out there. You got to go to bat. You got to pitch. You can't just sit back and be a spectator. This is the Rebbe. It's unbelievable. What a difference. What a difference. Yes, Yitzchak.
Jonathan Sachs, in a number of his writings, makes the point that you made very well. Same point.
He's a terrific Jonathan.
He went to see the Rav.
Yeah.
He went to see about the Rebbe.
Right.
And what the Rebbe did to him,
right,
is he said to him, we need manhigim.
Right.
And he said, so now I don't agree with people, he said, that say that the Rebbe was a manhig. He was a man, not of 1,000 chassidim, of 1,000 manhigim.
Right.
He created manhigim, who went out to all parts of the world to share.
Right, this is the story we're going to come to. We're going to come to Jonathan Sachs attributes his being a rabbi to the Rebbe. And Jonathan Sachs, you should know, he didn't come from a rabbanish home. He didn't know rabbanish politics, understand? And he was a man who could have been a world-class professor of philosophy. And the Rebbe pushed him with a few words, changed his whole life. And we got to give credit, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, everything the man does is in great dignity. You know,
he's working on now
is writings.
Every week he's writing the Parsha of the Week as the Rebbe gave it.
Wow, wow. Right? Halavai. Miller already did something like that, but let's see what Jonathan Sachs comes up with. Let me just make a bracha. Baruch atot men melech olam shekonim v'ro. I want to go one step further. Page 333. And here's something that's very moving for me personally. As you all know, in the first rabbinate at 6162 in Lower Marion Synagogue, Bally Kindred, Pennsylvania, I got my face slapped very heavily. And looking back, it could have destroyed my life, but it made my life. But it was not easy. I don't want to dismiss that incident as being lightweight. A kid of 23, hotshot, coming out of the yeshiva, Talmud of the Rav, I already had two masters, and suddenly the Treif Wine incident and all that goes with it. I don't want to minimize it. And then a year later, I couldn't remain, even though I'd been re-elected. As I told you, I think the vote was 9-7 on Mashahu Kazer. I gave Rabbi Dolphin a copy of Charlie Lieben's article, Charlie Zichrono Levracha, on the American Rabbinate, the Orthodox Rabbinate at that moment in time. It made Charlie famous, and I'm the case study at the end where it says, young rabbi, write in Aaron Rothkopf. When I came to Maplewood, so one man who was a Baal Tshuva, his father had been a Sheikhet, and he was a Baal Tshuva, successful, very well-known medical doctor, and he decided to build a shul. He named it after his father, Beth Ephraim. And lo and behold, there are now a few families, and there were people whom he operated on who owed their lives to him, their limbs to him, so they would come to shul to help make a minyan. And I was the first rabbi they engaged. And of course, I remained there till the day I went in Aliyah. In my office hangs a picture, hangs the invitation to the farewell breakfast the week before we sailed. And so many people were crying, the rabbis leaving. I was the only rabbi they knew, and I did build it from the ground. Today, no one even knows my name, but that's life. You have to accept that. I thought when Washington would be published, someone from Maplewood would contact me. I would love to go back and see what's happened and give a share there. And I don't think anyone in the world knows my name. Malk and I once drove back. We could barely find the place. And finally we found it. We thought they changed the streets. And we see a frum lady driving by, looking at us, sitting there, and she didn't even have the seichel, stop the car and come over and ask, can I help you? What are you here for? What are you looking at? You know, looking at the new shul they took over the church, etc., etc. But that's life. What was fabulous about Maplewood, South Orange, we're opening up this Orthodox shul and tremendous reform and conservative temples. And I actually became friendly with the reform rabbi and the reconstructionist rabbi and the conservative rabbi. As a matter of fact, if I mentioned yesterday, Mordechai Kaplan rode in my car and I had that whole discussion with him I referred to yesterday. It was coming back from the shiva, the conservative rabbi, when I was sitting on Rehov Chernichovsky for his wife, who had just died, and Mordechai Kaplan, and yours truly came, Lenachem Avil, and then I had to go teach in BMT, and BMT then was around the corner, Rehov Ababonel, from where Mordechai Kaplan lived. So I knew them very well. So I have to tell you, Louis Levitsky was a Reconstructionist, and there was no way you could convince him that he's off the path. He's the one who heard me speak at a funeral in 63, 64, and offered me a conservative shtetl, $25,000 a year, when between YU and my shtetl, I was making $8,000. And when I said, does it have a mechitza, what's the word they use if you're torturing your family? There's a word, I'm missing the word now, but he let me have it. Anyone know the appropriate word? A masochist, that's the word he used. I didn't know what the word meant, I had to look it up. And Teddy Friedman was an interesting guy. He's one of the three who's the conservative rabbi. He was the one who signed the response, so-called, permitting driving on Shabbos. And he came from an east side home. He went to Yeshiva Sibbes Chochanan. And here he is, a JTS graduate, all the way already, no longer even a centrist, permitting driving on Shabbos, the shul. Oy vey. All right, but Teddy was a nice guy. And we got along very well, and he's the guy I debated with, where he went berserk when I called him a Catholic rabbi. It's written up in Washington. I don't have time now, you can read it. It was one of the smartest words I ever said. And when I came home that night, exhausted, wiped out, Malka says to me, you wasted your time, you're tired, you have to teach tomorrow at the yeshiva. Why do you do these things? Who are you going to make from? And it was one of the few times in her life that my wife was totally wrong. Okay? it turned out there was a family sitting there that were thinking that maybe conservative Judaism is not good, not right, and they heard what I said to Teddy Friedman about you're a Catholic rabbi, you live one way, you don't drive. I said, do you drive on Shabbos? Of course not. So how do you permit the people to drive? What are you, a Catholic rabbi? And the audience went crazy. That comment pushed this family over the hill. They became Orthodox. They came in Aliyah. They probably have today 100 direct descendants, all a result of a young rabbi knocking himself out at the YM, what was it, the center of Irvington, New Jersey. I have down in the, I give you exact location where it took place. Now, what's interesting was, among all my spiritual colleagues, the frumest was Rabbi Herbert Weiner. Do you recognize the name? Zichrona Levracha. Herbert Weiner, he was a Reform rabbi with a soul who was seeking, who was searching. He had a sabbatical, he spent it in Israel, he attended Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook's lectures. He later wrote a book, The Nine and a Half Mystics. By the way, when Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook found out he was a Reform rabbi, he didn't let him come to his classes anymore. He was very upset with him, if I recall correctly. He writes about it in The Nine and a Half Mystics. I can only tell you that Herbert Weiner was truly a spiritual Jew who ultimately became totally observant in his own personal life. At the farewell dinner, when he told his congregants he's retiring, leaving the rabbinate, coming in Aliyah, so he gets up and he says, and I'll let you in on a little secret. Until now, I have secretly been an Orthodox Jew. And the president got up and said, Rabbi, it's not such a big secret. We all knew you were an Orthodox Jew serving in a Reform congregation. Now, he had interaction with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And here you have to see, you see, when I was younger, I have to tell you, I would have been like Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. I would have smacked his face and thrown him out. And one time, I was a stupid kid, a kanoi. I learned with life that you can always be a kanoi, but you have to cover it with honey. And you don't throw anyone out. You talk. You can argue. Today already, I hear my grandson who showed me a clippage from Zahavi. It's some Israeli character. Who not married, who went through the wars, lost many friends. You should hear him maledict. They chassid talking with him, where the chassid says he believes in God and God will help. And he cuts him off and he gives him a list of people who were killed. And my grandson said, what would you say to him? And I said, look, I'll tell you, I would say to him, study the book of Job and study the book of Kohelet. They had ultimately the same complaints that you have. And I can't explain everything. I'm only a human being. That's the message of Job. Were you there when the world was created? Are we there? The ultimate truth. I've had some incidents in life that opened my eyes overwhelmingly. There was someone who had illness at an early age. I couldn't understand such a tzaddik being punished. And then I found out a secret that no one has revealed, who this man and what he did and why he was fired from his teaching position. And boy, I felt like Job at the end of time, whose eyes were being opened. But be it as it may, I said, we're not going to understand everything. Your questions are good questions. I have the same questions. King Solomon had the same questions in Kohelet. Job had the same questions. But one thing I want to tell you, the greatest proof that God watches over us is that you're talking to me at this moment of time in the state of Israel after so many years of gullus, murder, persecution, death,
Hitler and all that goes with it. And we're here. Can you deny it? We've built a state. We have more than 6 million Jews here. Underline the number 6 million. That's what I would respond. And we can argue, we can debate, we can dialogue. But when we walk away, I hope we'll both stand up and say Yeheshmi Rabbah together. So the Rebbe spoke with Herbie Wiener. And Rabbi Wiener later describes part of his conversation with the Rebbe. We'll pick up with that next week. It all is a continuation of the Jew, the individual, the goal, what you have to accomplish. And Wiener hits the Rebbe with a question, seemingly a difficult question. And it's just awesome how the Rebbe will move the question sideways and give him a powerful message that colors his thinking. Now, as I recall, the Wieners had two sons. I don't know if both are Orthodox, but I certainly know that one is totally Orthodox. And I want to tell you what a dummy I was in the rabbinate. A few times the kids came to daven in my shul, and in my sermon, I said negative things about the Reform movement. With a little seichel, I would have understood if the two sons of the leading Reform rabbi in the immediate area are visiting the shul, it's not the time to be critical of the Reform movement. And I apologize, and I attribute it to youth. Chatati, aviti, pashati, and I don't have to say an extra word. Next week, by the way, in addition to picking up on Rabbi Wiener, we're going to pick up as well on Rabbi Shmayaru Gur-Ayeh, and I want to speak a little bit more about him. And we're going to come back to the big machloket. Next week I get involved with the Rebbe on another level altogether, as you will see. And Be'ezrat Hashem, we will enjoy it immensely. So what have we said today? First of all, there were a lot of comments to fill in the last few shiurim, and the comments they have elicited from the masses that are out there. But we continued with the concept of the role of a Jew, the responsibility of a Jew. And yes, it is so different than any other Hasidus or any Litvishi yeshiva. And it's not that the Rebbe was a great scholar. Scholarship didn't affect this aspect of life. It's not that the Rebbe was a great administrator. Yes, no, it's not that. It's that the Rebbe had an unbelievable concept that he put into motion. The concept may have been there before in Hasidus in general, and certainly in Chabad. But it's one thing to have a concept and one thing to turn it into a vibrant movement. And that is Shluchim. And we're going to come back to this and going to go into great detail in statistics. There's a world to be done. But if you understand this gem of a concept, you have the key to understanding Chabad. Also, I sharpened the difference between the Rav and the Rebbe. It's true they both learned in Berlin together, but the Rav goes away with a Weltanschauung for 2016 that we all have to go to college. The Rebbe, if Mark Wiener's anecdote is correct, he climbed up on a roof. Baruch Hashem, he didn't fall off. Does everyone have to climb up on a roof? It's a different attitude altogether. Now, I just want to mention that they give this out in the Kollel. My classmate, my dear friend of my youth, Rabbi Dr. Yisrael Levitz, you remember Yisrael Levitz, right? He published this volume on talking during Tefillah. Yitzchak, you want it? I need it back. When you finish...
Did he write anything on psychology and pastoral counseling?
Yeah. He's a very fabulous, fabulous individual. And I have to tell you, I knew his parents. His mother was a tzaddikit. You have no idea what it meant in the Bronx to raise from children. Now here, I just want to show you something noted without comment. Let's put it that way.
This was given to me, High Holy Day Drashot, by graduates of Chovevei Torah. All right. So I'm intellectually curious. I have to be honest with you. I wanted to see the drashot. The drashot are nice. There's no great depth, but I could give a similar drasha perhaps in a synagogue where I'm talking to Balabatim. I couldn't give a drasha like this today because the synagogues that invite me to speak have a learned audience, but I can understand from Maplewood these drashot are very nice. But I just want to quote to you from one of the drashot. Let's hope this is not indicative of all of Chovevei Torah, by a Rabbi Stephen Exler, who was a graduate Yeshivat Chovevei Torah 09. He's evidently on the staff of Hebrew Institute of Riverdale, the Bayit. That must be Avi Weiss's place, right? Yes. And he gave this drasha Rosh Hashanah 5775. And here, it has not been a simple year. So many global events have threatened to push us off mission, the Pur report, boycotts of Israel, controversies of women's opportunity to wear tefillin, unrest and violence in Russia and the Ukraine, shootings around the United States, listen carefully, and the deaths of leaders like Ariel Sharon, Leonard Fine, Joan Rivers,
oh God,
and Rav Ovadia Yosef. Gentlemen, no commentary necessary. Anyone wants it? Enjoy. Next. I don't know why Yomo showed me a certain Gemara yesterday. I think
what are you doing?
Yomo showed me a Gemara in Yuma, that when one tzaddik dies, another tzaddik is born. You showed me that Gemara yesterday. I don't know why you showed it. Why did you show it to me? I know the Gemara.
Including the Rebbe was talking about the women who
were in terror. And of course the women. Okay. So I want to tell you, this is Marav. I don't believe Marav has an axe to grind. It's Marav from October 9th. My daughter gets it. I get. It works as follows. During the week, I don't read. You don't have to read newspapers. Actually, I read Israel. I look at it. But today, with the internet, it's unbelievable. Malka's yelling to me to come see the TV there, Lo Aleinu Be'er-Sheva. And I say, what? I'm in my bed reading about Reb Chaim Brisker, and I have the computer on. I say, it's right here on the computer in front of me. Who needs a TV? But for the weekend, I like to look at all the papers to get an idea what's happening in Israel, what people are thinking. So I get Yediot, my daughter gets Marav, and Makor Rishon, and we exchange all the papers, we see it all. Here's my dear students, there is a young man of 30 years living in Bnei Brak. He is a Gon Sheba Gaonim. They compare him to Rav Ovadia Yosef. They interview died in the wood Ashkenazim, Litvakim, and Ein Gomrim Olav et Ahalel. And they describe him that the most difficult shilas within a few seconds, he'll give you all the sources. His nickname in Bnei Brak is Harav Google. That's the article, Harav Google. What's interesting, his name, Rav Yisrael Schneer, he was born, Schneer in the Svadik means senor. He was born in France, Svadik family, evidently a well-to-do family, came to Israel at a young age, was educated in all the best Ashkenazic yeshivat, and he's a Gon Adir. So I tell you, I read the article, and you got to know who Weinreb is, what they say about him. So I have to tell you, Yesh Tikva Liachritainim. We don't have to worry. Now, for those of you who read modern Hebrew, this is from Makor Rishon, a whole section of a few weeks ago. Also, it's even earlier than that, dedicated to feminism. I strongly suggest you read every article in here they interview Greenberg, Blue Greenberg, Blue Ganella Greenberg, get a feel of the problems we face. And we're living it. We have to come out of it. And we have to give guidance. And I have a student, Rabbi Reuven Unger from Shalavim. So he always is amazed. He says, Rebbe, as he reminds me, he'll give you the exact date. I think it's 11, 12, 15 years ago. I spoke for Shalavim in a home in Lawrence. And I spoke about the state of Torah today. And I mentioned the greatest problem we're going to face is feminism. You know, went to some detail. And Reuven says he was in the audience and he thought, I'm off the wall, you know, feminism, the greatest problem. He said, boy, Rebbe, did you hit it on the head?
What paper is this?
This is Makor Rishon. Friday, they have many sections.
It's a religious newspaper?
Yeah, religious. Tzioni Dati. Makor, if you don't know what Makor Rishon is, you're not living in Israel yet. You follow me?
No, I am living in Israel. I'm just not living in the culture of Israelis.
Makor,
I'm in the Kotel every week.
No, Beseda, you are of American origins wandering in the state of Israel.
No, in Eretz Israel. The Kedusha of Eretz Israel surrounding me and permeating.
Charlie, what can I do? I love him. You understand? I stand corrected. Alex Glassman, you are absolutely right. The Rebbe bows before, but now it's a glass house. When you read Makor Rishon, it will be a golden home.
You'll have. I don't read modern.
Ah, so you got to get there. Okay? You got to get there. Force yourself. Read. You get the pulse. It's unbelievable. Some things you'll agree with, some things you won't agree with. By the way, I'm touching with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Don't think I'm not touching it. Okay. Now, again, I showed you, anyone who remembers Rav Chenoch Fishman from YU, this picture is so moving to me. This is a picture from the book on Rav Chaim Briska. There's Rav Chenoch, there's Rav Elchanan Wasserman's son, Rav Naftali Hashem Yikom Damo, and there is Rav Simcha Sheps. He later is at Torah Vadas. He later is my Rebbe at Solanta. We taught together in YU. What a picture. And here is Rav Shach at the wedding of his son Ephraim. There is Ephraim Shach as a youngster getting married. Finally, before we end class, the biggest news of all, the Mets defeated the Cubs second straight. And if anyone is a baseball fan, here are all the articles from the New York Times describing the last two games with the insight that only the New York Times has, how they turned baseball into a chachma with Rishonim, Achronim, and Kippel, and a Rashi, and a
Kaiser. Save that for Michael.
The New York Times. Give it to Michael, fine. Give it to Michael. My dear students, I wouldn't miss next Sunday's class for all the missiles that Russia has already sent to Syria. And boy, don't underestimate it. And ISIS, if I'm pronounced ISIS, they say, they're still on the map. It's amazing. Guerrilla warfare is the biggest problem you can have. It brought America down in Vietnam. It brought Russia down in Afghanistan. Who knows what will be yet in Syria? And this is the problem we face here right now. It's not an organized army. It's guerrilla warfare. Although what happened last night is very bad, because that's no longer good. That was planned. That was executed. That's not just the crazy 13-year-old kid taking a knife to kill every Jew in his way. We have problems. And if anyone here is a great military mind, I excuse you from class next Sunday. Meet with the Prime Minister and see what you can accomplish. Next Sunday we finish out the question of Tefillin and Chol HaMoed, splitting up into different minyanim. You'll see good common sense from Renasha HaKatan. And then we go into the question, and you wonder why it's an Orach Chaim. Can you learn Torah and Davin, and the woman sitting opposite you is half naked? And that leads to the question, how do you go on a bus during the summer? How do you go on a subway? And wait till you see the way Rav Menashe handles it and the way Rav Moshe handles it. very fascinating. Young people, as Yitzchak said to me yesterday, Aaron, when you give shir, you are a youngster. Ani model HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The only problem is that I won't be giving shir tomorrow, and I'm going to be a lot older. But Be'ezrat Hashem, next Sunday, I lose it again. Until we meet in health and happiness. Natan, a pleasure to have a YU graduate who has a soul. Dani, in health and happiness. Das Vidanya.